Omar makes a two-finger gesture, pointing at his eyes and then at me.
I'm watching your every move, he says. Morning is a delicate flower that...
His sentence gets cut in two as Morning takes his massive arm into a painful twist behind his back. A sharp gasp escapes his lips.
A delicate what?
She asks. Omar grunts his answer.
Warrior queen?
She releases him, grinning.
That's more like it.
In two strides, though, he's back between us.
She might be able to beat me up, Omar admits. But I'm bigger than you. Keep that in mind. And don't forget,
I'm watching you.
Morning groans.
Don't you have someone else to talk to? Someone you like?
Omar shoots Morning a betrayed look, like she's just revealed one of his darkest secrets. His eyes dart toward Parvin.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Ahead of us, the front group has reached the boats. Longway and Holly work the ropes, pulling them closer to shore. I follow Morning forward, but a question from Azima catches everyone's attention.
Speaker, are the rivers dangerous?
He exchanges a glance with Bekwe and Bali.
No more than the land.
Azima turns back to us.
So it's safe to say we could have a small competition?
That has the rest of the group grinning.
Genesis 11 against Genesis 12?
Azima suggests.
Last time we won.
Alex wags an obnoxious finger.
And what happened the 50 times before that? We spent a whole month crushing you.
Haven't you heard? Katsu snipes. You're only as good as your last game. That has the Genesis 12 crew calling out insults. Morning's eyes dart from her crew to me, and I realize she doesn't like the idea of splitting up out here in the unknown.
Look, she says out loud. We're trying to get there safely. It's not a competition.
I'm surprised when Longway leans into the conversation.
Will that be your excuse when we win?
It's impossible to not laugh at the idea of Longway talking smack. Katsu shakes him by the shoulders, like he just hit Morning with the deepest dig ever. Morning's concerns about separating from me burn to nothing as the heat of competition rises. She takes a long look at her old team.
To your stations,
she orders.
First one to Marriott wins.
Chapter 18. Old Rivalries. Emmett Atwater. Genesis 12 lets out a series of whoops and shouts. Following Morning is so bone deep that even Holly boards their ship and takes her usual station. Omar lifts both of his gigantic fists into the air like they've already sealed the victory. I shake my head with surprise when the entire Genesis 11 group rallies in a circle around me. Longway nods to the back of the ship.
I'll take the engine again.
Katsu wraps an arm around Jamie.
Drivers!
I'm up front,
Jazzy says.
Eye on the prize, y'all.
Azima's already hoisting herself up onto the deck.
I want to hit something.
I raise an eyebrow. So that leaves me...
As the captain,
Longway confirms, nodding his respect.
That's what you are.
I almost laugh. I thought I was a bad captain? Katsu slaps my shoulder.
You are, but don't worry. I was worse.
Let's do this.
I smile and file this one under S for surprises. Sometimes, my grandma used to say, you've got to file the good things, too. It takes a few minutes for all of us to board. Another few minutes to get used to the feel of the Nixian stations. The captain's chair is linked to every station by Nixia. It runs out like a flattened web to touch the backs of each individual console. It's a powerful feeling. It's been long enough now to forget what it felt like after I handed the reins off to Katsu. The slightest attention connects me to any of the operations on the ship.
I can feel Longway firing up the engine. I sense Jazzy swiping through settings to analyze the landscape ahead, all at my fingertips. Speaker joins our ship and takes his post at the defensive station opposite Azima.
Bally will follow in a separate vessel and ensure our protection.
Across the way, Morning's giving orders. I can almost feel the thunder in her voice. She throws a look my way and smiles.
Thinking about boarding our ship again?
If I wanted to board, I say, smiling back in challenge, I'd board. The engines of both boats start to roar. Morning winks before turning back to crouch next to Parvin's display system. I turn my attention back to the ship, back to my crew. It's like day one on the waterway, I say. Empty scoreboard, grudge match. Longway actually sighs.
I miss the scoreboard.
That has the others laughing. Over the noise, Jazzy's voice buzzes into the comm. She keeps it carefully at the volume of a whisper.
Ammit, I've got a route.
I cross the ship to stand at her shoulder.
Already? Well?
Jazzy looks up guiltily.
I kind of cheated.
I laugh.
Cheated how?
She shows me her screen.
I can see the route they're planning.
As we watch, highlighted directions start to extend through the convoluted riverway. I glance over to their ship. Morning and Parvin are bent over the screen, deep in discussion. Parvin traces a finger, and their plan continues to draw itself onto our map. I can't help laughing.
But can't they see our screen?
Jazzy shakes her head.
It's all in the screen-sharing interface. The two ships are linked, probably by design so we don't get too lost out here. But I've hidden our screen, so we have eyes on them, and...
Jazzy shrugs.
They can't see us.
I laugh again. Perfect.
Hey, Speak, can you come take a look?
He crosses over and examines the layout.
Impressive. They traced the paths ahead and eliminated the routes that eventually choke out or wind unnecessarily.
He leans over the forming map and double taps a split in the river.
I'd follow them until this point. They're cutting back, losing time, because they think these waterfalls aren't safe. I know a way across.
Jazzy marks the location and logs the rest of their route into our system. She grins back when it's done.
Great find, Jazzy, I say with a nod. And thanks, Speak.
A look shows Morning's back in her captain's chair. She nods over to me.
2 minutes?
Sounds good. Our crew's looking comfortable at their stations, but the sight of Morning reminds me who we're up against. This is the same Genesis 12 team that destroyed us for an entire month. We need an edge.
Listen up. I let my voice whisper through the Nixian connections. I want to try something. Jazzy, I want you to start. Push your energy towards Speaker. Speak, I want you to push yours to Katsu. Katsu to Longway, and so on. All around the ship. Understand?
Is this really the time to try something new?
Jamie asks. But Speaker's voice follows. He's either curious or concerned or both.
How do you know how to do that?
I shrug. Picked up a few tricks. Let's try it out. Speaker raises a curious eyebrow as the power around us shifts. Jazzy directs her energy to him. He glances back at me before shoving the energy around. The others follow suit, and before long, I can feel the rhythm of the Nixia turning in circles around me. It revolves 3 times before picking up its own momentum. Longway's the first to understand.
Power, he says. That's a lot of power. Keep it orbiting, I whisper. If we can sustain the rhythm, all we have to do is pull from the energy it's making to do our manipulations. Everyone fathom?
There are nods all around. Speaker shoots me another curious look, but says nothing. Morning cups her hands.
10 seconds!
The engines throw out revolutions. Longway's eyes are wide as he prepares to use the power at his fingertips. Both crews grip the railings, leaning forward in anticipation.
5 seconds!
Time slows to nothing. My vision of the river narrows. It's our ship and their ship, in a single streak of waiting blue. Morning shouts, and both engines roar as we fire through the water like missiles. The entire crew lurches back in their seats, but Longway steadies the power after a few seconds. The front of our ship pushes out past Genesis 12. Morning eyes us with suspicion as the lead increases, a full length around the first curve of the river. I glance back long enough to see her eyes go wide as she realizes what I'm doing. I can hear her shouting new orders.
Let's hear some readouts, Jazzy,
I call back. She sounds off a few warnings. Jamie and Katsu work to make adjustments as we cruise around another bend. A dense island waits in the distance. The river ropes around each side of it, each split no wider than 30 meters or so.
Taking the western split.
Katsu and Jamie swing us that way. I have half an eye on the unfolding universe of the river. The water is dark enough to hide its dangers. The banks are overgrown, too. Everything in the Imago's world feels like it's at war with something else. But the rest of the time, I'm glancing back at Genesis 12. Morning's marching around, giving orders. They're moving faster. But I'm guessing she's still getting them used to the shared Nixian manipulation.
Rocks on our right!
Jazzy calls. Jamie's voice shakes through the calm.
We can't cut that hard at this speed.
The boat tilts the right way, but I can tell we're coming on too fast. I'm about to order Longway to dial back the power when Azima manipulates her defense station. She forms the gigantic hand she always liked to use in the waterway. We watch as she lowers it, cupping the water with a massive palm. Our boat's nose pivots just enough. Everyone holds their breath as the side scrapes harmlessly past the rocks and Azima raises her station out of the water.
Great work, Azima, I say. Let's keep it moving.
The next few kilometers pass quickly. Morning pushes her crew within 500 meters, but we're firing on all cylinders too.
We're approaching the marked split,
Jazzy announces.
Let's put on a show,
I say.
Make it look like we screwed up.
Jazzy nods. We glide over the water, heading directly toward the staggering stones that mark the waiting divide. Genesis 12 keeps the pace. At the last possible second, I make the call.
Move us east!
Our boat dives that way. Genesis 12 glides the opposite. I look back and throw them my most surprised look. I try to make my voice loud enough so they'll hear every word.
No! Back that way! Come on, Jazzy!
The engines roar, and we catch a final glimpse of their crew before a veil of riverside trees swallows everything.
You still have a ways to go on your acting career, Jamie snarks.
Katsu laughs.
And the award for worst dramatic role as a ship captain goes to...
I laugh. I would throw both of you overboard. Speak is probably honor-bound to save your sorry asses because of the treaty, but that won't stop me from doing it. They exchange a look and laugh again. I shake my head before eyeing the riverway. The sudden absence of Genesis 12 brings out the wonders of Grimgarden. It was easy to think that this was our river. That's what living on Earth has taught us. We can treat anything like it belongs to us. It's clear, though, that we're nothing more than guests here. The normal inhabitants have taken note of our passing. We see a pair of fish streak through the water on our right before breaching. Their scaled bodies spiral out, unexpected wings flung wide. Water splashes in an arc as they flap through the air and cut overhead, eager to duck back into the cover of trees. Jazzy keeps scanning around every corner, relaying potential dangers or asking for more speed when the scans come back clear. The orbiting power of the Nixia continues to hum in startling harmony. I think about the first time Morning taught me how to do it, how our steps synced up effortlessly. The same thing is happening now. I can sense each moment before it comes. It's like precognition. A feeling that says Longway's about to gun the engine, or Jamie's about to shift our rudders. Speaker's reaction is telling, too. We have a knowledge he didn't expect us to have. Halfway to Myriad Station, a golden glow highlights the water in front of our ship. Jazzy points out the glittering lights, and Speaker explains, "Look, Lux." Their bright pattern extends out like an arrow. Jazzy watches them long enough to notice the pattern.
"They're taking all the right turns. How do they know which way we're going?"
"Intuition," Speaker answers. "The look locks will choose correctly for a while. 20 turns, 50 turns, long enough to lure you into trusting them."
"And then what happens?"
Azima asks, fascinated.
"The very moment you stop attending your instruments and start trusting their lead, they will take a turn that goes nowhere. They will distract you into a bank or a sandbar. After the crash, they'll feed on the dead."
"Everything out here is so lethal," Jamie complains. "Next you'll be telling us to avoid stepping on fallen leaves or something."
"That is a sound practice," Speaker replies, missing Jamie's sarcasm. "The Greya create traps beneath the larger piles. It is always better to avoid them."
Jamie looks around at us and just shakes his head. The golden school of Looklocks highlights our way for a while, but their own hunt is interrupted by another. Azima points to a nest hanging from a tree on the eastern banks. It looks just like a massive beehive, but the entryways are bigger than my head. I'd rather not meet an insect that needs a home that big.
"A vian nest," Speaker announces. "They're one of the..."
But movement cuts off his sentence. Three creatures, vians apparently, come spiraling through the dark doorways of the hanging nest. The creatures' muscled bodies are the color of steel, and they're no bigger than basketballs. All three of them land in the water, frantic limbs fighting gravity, and then they're up. My eyes struggle to follow their mad dash over the surface of the water. The school of Looklocks either sees or hears their approach, because the golden glow vanishes instantly. But that doesn't stop the hunters. Silver tongues stab down through the water like spears. Each vian circles as our ship passes, busy jaws crunching down on their catches before making a path back to their nest. For the next few kilometers, we forget we're in the middle of a race. We don't slow the pace, but all of us watch the river in the hope of witnessing more miracles. Finally, we're getting the hang of being the first human explorers on an alien planet. Speaker explains which distant bellows go with what creatures. He does his best to differentiate animals based on their splashes or by the residue they leave along the riverbank. Longway spots a trio of birds wheeling in the western sky. They're the first creatures moving slowly enough for my scouter to actually identify. The word Dirk dances into view. Speaker lets out a relieved sigh when the birds change course, vanishing beneath the cover of clouds. "What's up, Speak?" I ask. "Are Dirks dangerous or something?"
"In a way," he answers. "They are an indicator of danger. They know where there will be bloodshed. They feed exclusively on the dead."
I nod to him. "Like vultures. They always show up when animals die on the side of the road in our world."
"Many animals eat the dead," Speaker admits. "Dirks are different. They arrive before the death. Their arrival is more of a prophecy. Death will visit that place. It's an unnatural quality. We believe they gain insight by imbibing on the dead, a sense of who or what will die next. I will always be glad to see them turn away from us."
Speaker guides us through the tighter passes in the river. We make good time, good enough time to feel like we have a chance at winning. I can't stop my eyes from occasionally flicking up to the west, searching for the carrion birds. A few times I think I've spotted them, wheeling through the trees. But by the time our line of sight clears, there's nothing but clouds. Chapter 19. Myriad Station. Emmett Atwater. Jazzy's the first one to spot Myriad Station in the distance. It looks like an old man sitting on the riverbank, gray-green shoulders hunched, feet dangling in the river. Our approach sharpens all the details. There's the main building riding along the banks, then two parallel bridges that connect with another building. The second structure sits 50 meters out on the river and looks like a faded pearl. We can see water rushing through massive intake valves at the base of the structure. My mind runs back through images from science classes, faded hydraulics charts and textbooks that were usually older than me. Jazzy pings a location near the south face of the main building. I squint through the approaching dark and spy a pair of docks waiting in the distance. No sign of Genesis 12? I ask. Jazzy smiles back. Nothing on the scans. Azima raises both arms in triumph. It feels good to win. Take us in. There's a slight shift, like a passing breeze, as Jamie and Katsu direct us that way. Speaker rises from his station as we cross into Babel territory. He looks uncomfortable.
Where did you learn to use the substance that way? He whispers.
Morning figured it out. He lifts an eyebrow.
That's a unique method. Not one we thought Babel knew.
They still don't. Do you know why it works that way? Why it's so much stronger?
Speaker considers the question carefully. It's a return to the substance's natural state.
Natural state? I ask, confused now. But it's buried in the ground. I can tell I pushed Speaker to the edge of his comfort. He shakes his head.
This is a topic best left to the experts in Seven Set. We can discuss it there.
I nod a concession as the boat bumps the docks. It's a fair request from Speaker. Why discuss trade secrets in one of the only places Babel can call a stronghold? My mind skips from the discussion back to the base. Corporal West should be waiting for us. I'm trying to imagine what he'll be like. Kit had a boundless energy, an almost innocence. But no one comes striding down the docks. No lights flick on in the building. Instead, the sun continues to set as Azima leaps down and starts tying us up, a grin on her face.
We win again, she says. Nice call, Emmett.
I nod back, but now my mind's racing in a few different directions. I'm not sure why West hasn't come out yet, or at least given some sign that we should come in. And there's the annoying itch of fear for morning, too. It's not like her to lose, at least not by this much. Let's make contact with West, I say. Then we'll come back and check on Genesis 12. Our approach, though, is greeted with silence. A sense of dread snakes through my gut, and I decide to go with the feeling. Weapons out, just in case. We reach a section of the docks that runs parallel to the river. A single arched doorway has been carved into the side of Myriad, about 100 meters ahead. My eyes don't stop moving. I've got that walking on the wrong street at the wrong time feeling deep in my gut. There's only the river, the building, our footsteps. The dock brings us into Myriad's shadow. No signs of West. No signs of anything. Inside, I order. Let's keep close, eyes open. But before we can reach the door, it shoves open. Holly marches out and holds it in place, eyes empty, posture rigid. We all stare at her as groans echo from inside.
Damn it!
Alex's voice sounds from within. She ruined our surprise! Our group stumbles inside, up a double-wide ramp, and into a common room that's almost identical to the one in Foundry. Someone flips on the lights, and we spy members of Genesis 12 hidden around the room like they were preparing for a surprise party. Morning grins down at us from the balcony above.
I told you that I don't lose.
Speaker stares in confusion. Our whole crew does.
But we didn't see your boat,
Jazzy says. Parvin adjusts her glasses.
That was kind of the point.
Morning gives her team a few moments to glory in their win before pointing out the obvious elephant in the room.
Now that that's out of the way, what do you say we go find Corporal West? I'm guessing you didn't see him on your way in?
No sign of him.
We found signs of him,
Morning says, nodding to the entrance.
Just didn't want to investigate until we knew you had safely arrived. After we arrived, of course.
I shake my head at the dig. Lead the way, Captain. The whole crew moves toward the doors. The landside entrance overlooks a stretching plain. With the sun almost fully set, we can just make out another river cutting a path to the east. Morning gestures to a set of tire tracks running downhill, a little south. A standard Babel knapsack sits right where they begin. It's unzipped. Half the contents spilled onto the ground.
Corporal West went for a little joyride,
Katsu says.
Maybe,
Morning admits.
I think it's worth sending a group out after him.
It takes about 2 seconds to figure out what she means. Let me guess. Your prize for winning is kicking your feet up in the base while we investigate? Morning raises one eyebrow.
Do you even know me? Our prize for winning is that we get to go investigate. Enjoy holding down the fort while we have all the fun, second place.
It's not hard to see why Morning was such a good leader. She's smart enough to make every task seem like fun. There's no complaint from anyone on Genesis 12. Her intensity is infectious, and in seconds, the whole crew looks ready to march across the planet for her. Bally, Beckway, and Speaker have a quick discussion. They decide that Speaker will stay behind with us. Morning takes a second to walk over and stand next to me, all smiles.
You know, you look pretty damn cute when you're mad.
Who said I was mad?
There's this thing you do with your eyebrow.
I stare blankly at her. What thing?
Oh,
she says, laughing to herself.
You don't even know you do it, do you?
She gives my hip a little bump before marching off, barking orders, becoming the commander again. I stare after her.
What thing?
It takes about 2 minutes for the ranks of Genesis 12 to form up. Morning hands the lead to Bally, who knows the area better than any of them. We watch as they descend into the darkening valley, one by one. Their figures merge with the landscape until they're all gone. Our group returns to Myriad. Katsu heads straight for the kitchens, while Jazzy and Azima start up a conversation with Speaker about sports in Seven Set. I'm thinking a bed sounds like a good idea, when the realization strikes like lightning. Corporal West isn't in the base. Jamie looks ready to join the others before he notices the look I'm throwing his way. I nod over to one side and shoulder my knapsack. He walks smoothly past the conversation and heads in my direction.
What? Is something wrong?
West isn't here. Seems like a good time to visit the med bay and patch you up. Understanding clicks into place.
You think there are more of them?
Only one way to find out. Jamie adjusts his scouter. I watch as he blinks through a few settings and then gives the voiced command.
I need to go to the medical bay.
The visor panel of his scouter flashes with light. Jamie blinks once, and my own scouter lights up with an access request. I nod at the accept button, and an actual blue line holograms into my vision, leading us on through the base.
The hell? How do you know how to do that?
I read the instructions, Jamie says.
Didn't you?
I shrug. I've kind of just been winging it. How much time do we have?
Depends on how fast your girlfriend finds West.
I raise an eyebrow at that.
What?
He asks. My girlfriend?
Aren't you, I thought,
Morning? Next subject, I suggest. Jamie shakes his head as we turn down the first hallway and run right into Longway. All my red flags go up for some reason. I start to throw out an excuse, give him some reason we're wandering off through the base, when Jamie says,
Want to see the frozen soldiers?
Longway's eyes narrow. How many? He asks it like there's a certain amount that's really worth his time.
70?
Jamie guesses.
Trust me, you want to see this.
Longway takes a second before nodding.
Let's go.
And just like that, the three of us are moving through the halls. I don't know why my first instinct was to exclude Longway. I'm glad Jamie invited him, though, because maybe that was all it really took. He might have said no aboard Genesis 11, but now, a lot has changed. We might not ever be close friends, but at least we're not staring at scoreboards every night before we go to bed. We're together down here. We need each other to survive. I need to start remembering that, even about my oldest rival. The route takes us back to the waterside half of the building. Outside, I can hear the river churning past. It's just loud enough that I almost miss the footsteps. Jamie and Longway do miss them. In less than a breath, I've got them both by the collars of their suits, and I'm dragging them into a maintenance room. The footsteps echo louder and louder. From the shadow of the room, we all watch Holly walk past. She marches toward whatever task is waiting down the hall, looking lost as hell. The second she turns the corner, we're back on the move. Jamie gives me a nod.
Nice one.
Longway says,
You could have just told us to watch out.
I try to ignore that. As the route takes us outside, across the first of the two bridges that connect Myriad with its floating counterpart. Jamie looks for signs of movement along the docks before signaling us across. We keep low, moving patiently. One left turn, up a flight of stairs, and we're standing in front of a familiar door. Jamie pushes it open and lights flick on. It's the exact same layout as Foundry's medroom. Three gurneys arranged in a half circle. A sink built into one corner. Stacks of medical supplies and a makeshift shelving system. I cross the room and shove aside the center gurney. There are no scuff marks along the edge, but that doesn't mean the trap door isn't there. It just means Corporal West had less reason to visit his batch of frozen Marines. Or he was more careful about it. My finger snags on an edge, and I trace it up to the latch. One solid tug has the whole thing folding upward.
We're getting good at this, Jamie says.
Longway eyes the hidden passage.
Is it dangerous?
Only if you wake them up, I reply with a smile. The stairwell leads to a familiar hatch-wheeled door. Two spins are all it takes to bring us face-to-face with Babel's finest. Body after body. Lining the walls like toy soldiers waiting to be activated. Jamie strides forward. I can see his fists are clenched.
More soldiers, he says. They've got an army down here.
Longway reaches up to touch the glass front.
It's like the Terracotta Army. I saw them when I was a child. I didn't want to go too far into the room. I was afraid they might come to life.
I don't know about those, I reply. But these ones require a code for activation. Come on, let's get back to the others. We needed to come down here and confirm this. We'll take it back to morning now. This is pretty good ammunition for our negotiations with the Imago. Longway starts walking back toward the entrance, but Jamie holds his ground.
It's not enough.
A hum shakes the air. He manipulates his Nixia. I can't make out the shape he's chosen until he takes a swing. His blunted crowbar lands against the glass. One swing and it almost shatters. Jamie takes a second swing and a third. I stand there frozen, as Longway's instincts finally kick in. Broken glass rains from overhead as Longway reaches him. My body finally swings into motion.
Jamie!
I shout.
Cool it, man!
Longway pulls him to one side, struggling. Anger burns in Jamie's eyes. It reaches down through the veins of his neck. He tries to fight past Longway and finish the job. A hiss of air sounds. The damage has already been done. All three of us look up as the glowing green dot above the unlucky Marine starts to flicker red. Cracks web their way through the entire glass panel.
Get him out! Longway, move him!
Jamie fumbles his crowbar as Longway stumbles with him toward the entrance. I slide past them, careful to avoid the glass. There's a matching keypad at the base of the Marine's cryogenic chamber, but Kit never told us the code. West isn't even at the base. He might die. I snatch Jamie's fallen weapon. It takes a second to force the image forward, manipulating the substance that was responding to Jamie's touch just seconds before. I picture the same substance I used to lock Rothi out of the launch pod. The Nixia reaches back through my thoughts, carving itself into the right form. The black spreads in a crackling wave. I give the substance a helpful shove, glass crunching underfoot, until the whole thing suctions to the corners. It seals the dying Marine inside. I'm not sure if I'm saving him or killing him, but the second the air stabilizes, the red light flickers back to green. I wait for a minute. The light stays green. I let out a huge sigh of relief and move back to the entrance. Jamie stands off to one side, looking like a punk kid who got caught stealing something at the mall. I do my best to channel Pops as I grab him by the collar and pull him in close. Use your anger the right way. He tries to shrug me off, but I don't let him loose. I'm serious, Jamie. These might be our enemies when they wake up. Or maybe they're just people Babel hired. Maybe Babel lied to them the same way they lied to us. We can't know that when they're in a sleep freeze and suctioned to the inside of a buried spaceship. If you want to sink down to Babel's level, take shots at people who can't defend themselves, be my guest. Just don't involve me next time. Fathom? He shakes his head. If it was you in there, what would they do? I'm not them. I don't plan to be. Jamie looks ready to snap back, but instead he nods. Longway raises an eyebrow. This is why I usually stay in my room. I let out a laugh. And miss out on all the fun? The three of us slip quietly back outside. Jamie's still hot with it as he leads us back over the bridge. All his anger and hate for Babel keeps building. I need to put out that fire before it burns in a direction dangerous enough to get him hurt. Halfway across the bridge, there's movement. A figure emerges from the opposite end of the bridge, coming on quickly, long, unpanicked strides. I squint through the shadows and can tell it's not one of the Genesis kids. It's an Imago. Speak? I'm running through excuses, reasons why we're down here. When the light finally finds Speaker's face, and all the features are wrong. The approaching figure has a sharper chin, more angled eyes. A Nixian implant shades one eye like a swooping shadow. Not Speaker. Not a friend. Jamie's caught mid-step. I watch him flinch, legs frozen, as the stranger raises a blunt, pitch-black weapon. I remember, in the space of a single breath, that he's unarmed. It swings down at an angle. Longway lowers a shoulder and knocks Jamie to one side. He pays for it, too. The incoming blow catches him across one eye and sends him spiraling to the ground. Momentum has Jamie smashing into the stone railing. The weapon comes back around, seeking a new target. My Nixia reacts faster than my thoughts can shape it. From my pocket to my hands, forming the familiar offhand of my boxing claws as it moves. All in less than a heartbeat. I answer the second blow with a raised arm and a firm step. The Imago's eyes widen when I catch the blow, but he swings a second time, and a third. Each shot comes with such quick succession that I can only block the blows, stumbling back as I do. There's no time to think, no time to draw my other glove into existence as the Imago presses forward. Two more testing blows, then he spins away, grasping for my control of the Nixia. It's unexpected, but Babel trained me well. The claw starts to close around my hand, threatening to break every bone. A mental shoulder shoves the Imago back. He gives a nod of admiration, then two more jabs, a hook. I deflect all three, but I can already feel my arms getting tired. Longway is still down. Jamie's moving but can't seem to take his feet. The Imago retreats a step.
You're worthy,
The sound of the voice shocks me. It's softer, feminine. I stare at the intruder and realize for the first time he is a she.
You will be my new beginning.
I can't tell if I'm exhausted or if the words just don't make any sense. I'm heaving each breath, hands up and ready, when she flicks one wrist. The Nixian weapon retreats into a section of her belt. I'm watching the substance mist through the air, thinking that somehow I managed to scare her off when she flicks her other wrist. And for once, I'm too slow. I see the glint too late, feel the prick before I can pull back, and now something's crawling up my throat. I stare at the imago's satisfied face as it blurs, as the bridge spins beneath my feet. My arm goes numb first, then my chest feels like it's locked up, beating against the bars of a steel cage. The stranger shows me a ring on her offhand. There's a hair-thin needle attached to the end of it.
Screwbone. An effective poison, is it not?
My tongue's too heavy to answer. I try to form a fist to throw a punch. She just laughs. There's a grunt as Jamie tries to rise but falls. The imago knocks him aside before lifting me up. I can feel the pressure of her hold, but only distantly, like I've already half fallen out of my body. I can't make my eyes close. I can't move my neck. Breathe. I have to tell myself to breathe.
Be calm,
she warns.
Get too worked up and your lungs won't be able to sustain it. It is not my intention to kill you, but I can't keep you from killing yourself if you panic.
She's not going to kill me. My brain lashes itself to that thought. Not going to kill me. Not going to kill me. But why? Why poison me? Light flashes across my vision. We're moving. Down a set of stairs. I can hear the river splashing. Everything feels dark and damp and dead. I'm set down on cold stones. Something splashes over my leg, and chills snake up my spine. The stranger cleans out my pockets of the only things that will make me dangerous. Anything with Nixia. My gloves, my player, all of it. I have a blurry view of her shoving it into my abandoned knapsack before tossing it aside. I hear it land with a thunk before sliding out of reach. I'm lowered into a boat. There's a muted grunt. The engines roar to life. And then, the lights of Myriad start to fade.
Chapter 20. Light in the Dark. Anton Stepanov. I move through the weightless dark. It's been 2 days roaming around Babel's no-grav tunnels. I keep imagining them as the space station's organs. They're dark and vital, and everyone forgets about them until they start to bleed. It took gutting an artery to lure in a friend. A single beam of light dances in the distance. I dig my fingers into the nearest panel to keep myself from floating into sight. Babel's Tiki has been fussing with the control panel for a few minutes. I was counting on them sending someone in to give me a good map back out. She's middle-aged, with dark red hair, and quick hands. The task took her half the amount of time I thought it would. Wires hang down from the back of a switchboard. The techies replace the pieces I fried and is bunching them together neatly, preparing to close the whole thing up and start back. I'm hoping she'll lead me to the nearest maintenance closet. I'd like to snag a few gadgets and make my life behind Babel's curtain a little easier. I need eyes on the station. I need to make contact with Vandermeer and our informant, Melissa Aguilar. But it's not as easy as pushing through an exit and hoping I land in the right room. If the wrong person sees me, this whole mission was for nothing. A soft click announces the task completed. Noiseless, I slip my fingers free of the wall panel. The slightest push sends me floating after the techie. She's more careful than I am, pulling herself along the wall, keeping tight to the slotted panels. I land soft along one corner of the tunnel before pushing off again. Down the rabbit hole we go. Her light leads me through the dark. We skip two tunnels before taking a right. I count 50 panels before she fully turns her body toward a slightly indented section. I let my fingers trail quietly along the ceiling, pulling my body to a stop. If she glances the wrong way, and her eyesight's any good, she'll see there are monsters in the dark with her. She doesn't look. The panel slides up, and light forces its way into her section of the tunnel. I flatten my body to the wall just in case, but it takes her 2 seconds to slide into the light and close the panel behind her. I shove down the hallway and stop myself in front of her chosen exit. I press my ear to the door and listen. There is the gasp of an airlock, footsteps, nothing. I take about 3 minutes to listen until I'm sure she's gone. Carefully, I slide the panel up just enough to look out. There is a bright room with enough space for 2 people. One of Babel's airlocks faces a perpendicular hallway. I count off the minutes in my head. I'm about to slide the panel up when a door directly across from the airlock opens. The red-haired techie waves to someone inside before slipping a utility belt back around her waist. She thumbs one of the devices and disappears down the hallway. Follow the leader, I think. The door is still open a sliver. My eyes trail the equipment hanging from the walls in neat stacks. My only hesitation is the techie's parting wave. Clearly someone's inside. Wait them out. Smoke them out. After a few restless seconds, I lift the panel and slide out into the light. It's now or never. A quick manipulation draws my Nixia into the shape of a mask. I pull the soft material overhead. If there are Babel cameras waiting for me in the supply room, I want them thinking it's some on-ship vigilante. I'd like my identity to stay a question mark for as long as possible. I adjust the eye holes and manipulate my knife into something less Anton. The dagger widens out into blunted knuckles. I flex my fingers on the grip, feel the weight of it, and start forward. There is an airlock separating the no-grav area of the station from the corridors that have been sealed off by Nixia to create a more Earth-like environment. There's a hissing sound as the airlock gasps open and suctions. As the entrance opens, Babel's imposed gravity comes slamming down on my shoulders. A quick glance left, a quick glance right. No movement. It takes about 20 seconds to get used to the restored gravity. I set my feet and take a deep breath. 1, 2, 3. My lowered shoulder opens the door. The room is stacked with goodies. Rows and rows of extra supplies. There's a single desk to my right. Occupied.
Forget something!
The sight of me forces the rest of the sentence back down his throat. He's too stunned to reach for an alarm or scream through a headset. He just blinks as I bring the weighted knuckle swinging across his temple. There is a nasty smack, and he spins from his chair, slumping to the floor. I cock my head back, listening, but there is no response from the hallway. Hesitation is death. I glide through the rows collecting conversion cables, live feed monitors, a set of pliers, a proper flashlight. I shove them into my knapsack before turning back to his desk. I eye the documents stacked there. Just maintenance requests full of half-assed signatures. The first drawer is all standard desk supplies, but the second one's a treasure chest. A pair of manuals. One turn of the pages shows me station schematics and maintenance procedures. I can't help laughing to myself as I stuff them into the bag. I take a few seconds to tear random items from the shelves. I do my best to make chaos, just in case they try to inventory the room and use what I took as the first step in an investigation. I salute my fallen comrade and glance back into the hallway. Empty. I close the door and hope no one notices the unconscious body for a few more hours. That should be plenty of time to find my way to some other section of the station. Airlock, panel, darkness. I smirk my way back through the tunnels. I keep moving until I find a comfortable nook to set things up. With the flashlight between my teeth, I locate Babel's monitoring cables and get to work. It takes a little less than an hour to patch my way through. I tap the screen on and watch as the image resolves. The security feed loops through images at 10-second intervals. A glimpse of half-empty docks, the underbelly of the station's exterior, an empty hallway. The fourth image hits me like lightning. It reaches down into my chest, takes my heart in both hands and pumps it full of forgotten life. The image brings life to every chamber, every vessel. The screen shows slumped shoulders, a familiar face. Bilal. He's alive.
Chapter 21. Sling. Emmett Atwater. I wake to the night, to wind, to two moons in a foreign sky. There's rope coiled around my body. I try to shift my weight, but there's barely any return from still-dead muscles. We're on a boat. It's a smaller version of the ones we've always used. I can hear it in the engine, see it in the condensed deck. The river thunders around us. Moss hangs down from branches reaching out over the riverbank. My kidnapper sits wisely out of reach. The angles and lighting of the bridge were enough to confuse me. Now, though, the differences between her and the male imago are plain. She's taller than they are, her chin more angled, her hair unshaven on the sides. The slight curve of her eyes is intensified by a Nixian implant. It almost looks like a dark comet with a tail spiraling toward her temple. I think of all the reasons someone would kidnap me. My mind jumps to the most frightening possibility. Isadora sent you. She looks back.
No, though I have heard rumor of her offers.
The answer leaves me more confused, more afraid. She adjusts her position and I finally see the tattoo on her exposed wrist. She wears it proudly. Moons swinging around in orbit. She's a sling. I force my voice through the rust. Who are you?
Jericho of...
She catches herself, though, before saying which ring. What? Get kicked out of your ring or something?
That is how they define me,
she answers.
I will make a new name in a new world.
The confidence in her voice sends a shiver down my spine. She sounds like Isadora. She feels absolutely certain about what she's doing. She's pleased with herself.
Especially now that I've captured a Genesis.
Genesis? She nods.
You are one of the Genesis. Our people are at an end. But your people, you are a beginning. With your help, I will walk through the doors that have been closed. You will take me where I could not have gone on my own. A new beginning. Genesis,
she repeats.
You are one of the Genesis.
I stare at her and finally start to understand. Understanding leads to fear. Speaker used the word cult when he described the slings. I see it now. There's something in the way she looks at me, the way her fingers drum restlessly. It has my heart rate rising. I watched these shows with moms before. Once you're in the car, on the boat, or locked in the basement, you're dead. I want to shout for help, but who would hear? Even as I try to fill my lungs with air,
It's like someone's parked a car on my chest. The effort shakes my body with violent tremors. Jericho frowns.
Do not strain,
she instructs.
The poison will fade. I need you strong again if you're going to take me to the stars. It is not my intention to kill you.
It takes a minute to catch my breath. You keep saying that, but your tattoo. You're a sling, aren't you? The word hits her like a thrown stone. She returns a dark look.
They use that word against us. As if they aren't exactly the same. It's just their political propaganda, nothing more.
Her answer doesn't make any sense. Propaganda? I thought... The tattoo on your wrist. It's orbiting around, using the planet like a slingshot.
And they said we would use you.
Jericho answers, echoing Speaker's words.
That we have betrayed our people in choosing this path. Choosing to take our lives into our own hands.
That's what you call this? Taking your life into your own hands? She nods firmly.
You're a light in the dark. A new way out of the labyrinth.
I swallow again.
You're not making any sense.
She points up at the moons.
I do not accept my end. I will go to your planet. Our rulers would have us wait on their mercy, their choosing. A lottery run by politicians.
She laughs her disdain.
I'm saying no to all of that.
Bad news. I can't get you there. As of today, I wasn't even sure I could get myself out. You can call me the Genesis or whatever, but I'm as stuck down here as you are. The words push at her barriers, her dreams. I can see the war inside her head before she growls back.
Even beggars will not give up their secrets easily. You'll resist, but eventually you'll teach me the ways of your people. You'll take me where I want to go, Genesis.
She turns away, busying herself with the ship's front console. I take deep breaths, test the movement of my toes and fingers. I'm feeling slight improvements, 1 minute at a time. For a while, we don't say anything. I watch the stars pass overhead. Both moons glare down at me. One as ghostly as a faded pearl, the other marred by those angry red scars. After a few minutes, I finally piece together the other thing that's digging under my skin.
You're a woman.
She turns back.
How observant of you.
But we... I thought there were only a few left. Babel's never seen a woman outside a Seven Set. And the whole no kids thing, I just kind of figured... Her eyes darken again.
More lies.
I lean back, unsure what to think about that. Who's lying? Babel or the Imago? Babel told us that was the whole point of us coming. A society without children. We were a temporary relief from the pain of that reality. Longway said it more clearly than Babel ever did. All the reports and the facts pointed to there being no women. It's not like the other Imago have contradicted it either. We know their people agreed to host Babel as long as they sent the young and the innocent. Those same currents ran through their negotiations over the bases, too. Kit was one of the three youngest Marines in space. Babel's been clear about this from jump. The Imago wanted us to come here.
I can't put the puzzle together.
Someone's removed a piece on purpose, trying to keep us from seeing the whole picture. Smart money's on Babel. I'm thinking through the clues when a loud ping echoes out from Jericho's radar. She hunches back over the console, muttering. It takes all my effort, but I push myself up into a sitting position, my back pressed against the hull. My hands and feet are both bound. There's still a nauseating wave of terror working through my stomach. Calm down, I think. Be calm. There's enough slack in the ropes that I can draw my knees up to my chest. Jericho notices, eyes me for a second before seeing I'm harmless. And turns back to the console. There's a blue dot hovering on the outer reaches of the radar. Someone is coming. All my Nixia is gone. The ship's engine sits up front, I realize. Jericho's wisely placed me against the back railing, centered between a pair of Nixian defense stations.